Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 29th, the year 2000, and in the fireside room this morning, Deanne Lagerquist conducts a session called Called by Our Inheritance, Is It Just a Job? So now let's join Deanne for her session.
Called by Our Inheritance, the subtitle today is It Just a Job? And what we're going to do is move from the more abstract, if you will, discussion of vocation that we began a couple days ago into a more applied discussion of vocation. One of the reasons I find the topic of vocation so interesting is that I think, like forgiveness, vocation is one of the theological notions that that's impossible to stay in the abstract about. Christology, soteriology, there's a whole bunch of those ology words, atonement theory, that it's real easy to go off into the philosophical wing of theology, which is well and good. I don't mean to diminish or to demean that work, but I don't think you want to live there. You can't always live there. And for Christianity and the gospel to be fully what it is, we have to get beyond merely, so not in the sense that I want to demean the intellectual side of theology, but we have to go beyond merely the intellectual, philosophical side of the theological and talk about how it applies to the whole of our lives. When I'm not at St. Olaf, when I'm at Holden, I teach at St. Olaf College, which continues to be a very conventional, in many ways, liberal arts college. We have 18 to 22-year-olds in residence. You know, so those are the kind of students I'm most often with, and I teach religion there. And in almost every class, there's a moment when we talk about which parts of you are involved in religion. Perhaps this is my affinity with the Pietist movement. I'm saying it's not just head. It has to be head and heart and hands. The whole of us is involved in religion. And forgiveness and vocation, I think, are really two of the key teachings of Christianity that propel us into the whole of life. It's where the significance of the gospel becomes clear. Okay, so what I intend to do today, I'm going to start by reading you an Ellen Goodman column, although I have no idea what Ellen Goodman's religious convictions or practice are. I do find often that in her columns there's an observation about the world that really allows me to get an entry point into something that I think is really important. So we'll start with this Ellen Goodman column. Then we're going to talk together about what makes good work. Then I will review a little bit of that abstract view of vocation, and then present to you some things under the rubric work and anthropology. Okay? So that's what I have in mind. So we'll start with this Ellen Goodman column. This is from this spring when Charles Schulz died, the cartoonist who made us smile. It was an eerie coincidence, said some. A fine piece of symmetry, said others. Charles M. Schulz died in his sleep just as the last peanuts was loaded onto the last trucks for the last home delivery. His life and his work were completed on the same day, sharing the same national curtain call. For half a century until cancer forced retirement, Charles Schulz was the scriptwriter, the producer, and the director of a repertoire company of small imaginary characters who never changed, never became trendy, and never grew dated. He penned more than 18,250 strips that ran 7 days a week. He drew them when his hands were strong and his line was sure. He drew them when a tremor made it hard to hold the pen. long after his income had topped $30 million a year. He got up every morning, drove to breakfast, then to his studio at One Snoopy Place, worked, went out for lunch, and back to work. Only once, under orders, did he take off more than 10 days. Finally, the creator and the comic strip, the life and the work, ended together. His friend, Lynn Johnston, creator of For Better or For Worse, said the end was as if he had written it that way. His son Monty said, "I think maybe he decided that his true passion was in the strip, and when that was gone, it was over." In one of the obituaries that talked about Charlie Brown and Linus and Lucy and Snoopy, his biographer said, "He spent a lifetime perfecting failure." After all, as Schultz himself once wrote, all the loves in the strip are unrequited. All the baseball games are lost. All the test scores are D-. The great pumpkin never comes. And the football is always pulled away. But Peanuts wasn't really about failure. It was about perseverance. It was about a hopeful, moon-faced boy holding a kite string day after day until the rain forced him indoors. It was about his character's perseverance and his own. It was about life and work, life as work. What do we make of a 77-year-old war veteran who had set off for war just days after his mother's death, who described his lifelong anxiety as that of a dog chasing after the family car, never knowing if they would ever return? What to make of a man who once asked of his characters, "Good grief, who are all these little people? Must I live with them for the rest of my life?" And then stayed with them until the day he died. In St. Paul, a man who lives in Schultz's childhood home reacted to the news of his death saying, "It's really too bad he couldn't enjoy his retirement." Too bad? Retirement? Indeed, Schultz once said, "Drawing a daily comic strip is not unlike having an English theme hanging over your head every day for the rest of your life." But another time, he wrote that he did cartoons for the same reason musicians composed. They do it because life wouldn't have any meaning for them if they didn't. That's why I draw cartoons. It's my life. Which is it? A theme paper hanging over his head? The meaning of life? Is it a shame he didn't retire? Or a blessing that he came to the end, work and life still entwined? There's something in my generation that looks on perseverance, on work as life, with admiration, envy, and unease. On the one hand, work, 30-year-old gold watch work, reminds us of the baker in the old Dunkin' Donuts ad, dragging himself to the kitchen, "Time to make the donuts." On the other hand, it reminds us of Claude Monet, poised to do his greatest art only after acquiring the skill and hands of a 75-year-old painter. Schultz's World War II generation stuck to their last out of anxiety or grit, luck or guilt. The 20-something generation skips from one work world to the next, reinventing themselves as swiftly as the internet. But my middle generation holds two competing views. One sees the courage to persevere, and other sees the courage to change. One admires those who find the right fit, Monet at 75, that's not too grandiose a dream, and the other admires those who break out at 50, 60, 70 to reinvent themselves. Last month, Nebraska's 56-year-old Senator Bob Kearney wrote himself two letters about his future. One letter explained that he was going back to private life, the other that he was running for re-election. The first one, he said, made me smile. Kearney chose the smile. Not long from now, the first baby boomer president will face retirement or reinvention. Then will come the rest of his generation. How many of us will know or find out what makes us smile? Not long before his death, Schultz realized that little boy is never going to kick the football. In a work and life that ended on the same day, I hope that the cartoon characters made Charles Schultz smile as much as he made the rest of us smile. Now, we could spend the whole day just parsing that. There are lots of observations and questions that I hope will come back into our conversation, but let's let it kind of float around us as we talk about what makes good work.
Satisfaction, fulfillment.
Okay. Having prepared, now I don't have any space to write in, but here, let's. Satisfaction. Fulfillment. What else?
It should be fun to do.
Fun?
It's its own reward. Although paycheck's nice.
Okay.
Yeah. You're motivated to do it. It's not that someone is telling you to do it. You want to. You're self-motivated.
Self-motivated. Okay. So it's or not compulsory. I notice this when I'm teaching. Sometimes I'll decide to assign a book for class because I want to read it, right? And then because it's assigned, and I'm even the one who did it because I'm the teacher, suddenly I don't want to read it anymore, right? Same thing happened to you ever? You think, oh, I want it. Something I want to do, I have this goal, and here's the training routine, and you're all excited about it, and then, oh, now I have to do it, I don't want to do it anymore. Compulsion.
You believe in it?
Okay, you believe in it. So it shouldn't be contrary to yourself, right? You don't, the good work should be consistent with who we are, what our values are. You don't want it to be a sellout.
Curiosity.
Say more about that, Peter.
Continuing curiosity.
Okay, so it continues to engage you. So if you're thinking about a job, you want one. Some people might say that you keep learning in.
Very much so. You challenge.
It's challenging. Now,
but not too challenging.
Not too.
It's right balance. It's manageable but challenging.
So if you want some kind of a balance, this is a word that comes up a lot when we start to talk about work. That balance. Challenging. Challenging enough to be interesting? Not so challenging as you feel unfulfilled, dissatisfied, and like you're having a hell of a time instead of fun.
I think it's productive and meaningful.
Productive.
And meaningful for yourself, maybe not the view of the society.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear all of that.
The job is meaningful for yourself, and not necessarily meaningful in the eyes of society.
Okay. So it may be that there's a job that you think is really important that has low status, right? So we think of daycare workers. We pay them diddly, right? They don't get much status. And yet, for people who have the gifts for that work, I can imagine it's quite sophisticated. Fulfilling. Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I think I would find it challenging in the negative sense.
But it's crucial. I mean, they're teaching your kids.
Oh, yes, I agree. I'm just saying I don't have the gifts for it.
No, I know. But boy, you know, it's a very important job.
It's a very important job. So, we have some things here that have to do with good work having to do with how it affects the worker, right? We have some things, if it's productive and meaningful, good work having to do with that, the product, right, of what comes out. Because we also use that phrase, good work, to describe an angel food cake that didn't fall, right? A paint job, that doesn't have wavy edges, didn't go on the window, right? So we use it both to describe the job, if you will, and the job accomplished. Good work is work that meets certain external standards, maybe. My father is an industrial engineer. An industrial engineer has a couple things that they're after. One is efficiency, which has kind of become a bad word, and quality control. Those have to do, I think, with two kinds of good work. Efficiency, as I understand it, in its more positive meaning, is to use resources well, right? Not to waste your energy turning each set of papers to staple them, but to turn the whole stack of papers and staple them, right? That's a kind of classic industrial engineer thing. Don't waste motion. But how many of you are on a church council where you feel like your time is wasted, right? You come and you spend 3/4 of the meeting getting nothing accomplished. It's not efficient, it's a bad use of your resource of time. It's stealing that from something else where you might be able to do good work. And especially if you come to the church council meeting and you waste your time and then you make a bad decision, right? You think, whoa. So then that's the quality control end. Good work also has to do with using your resources well and having something at the end that you can be proud of. Yeah, Dan.
I think all of those would suggest that good work also is beneficial beyond just yourself.
Yep.
It's beneficial to others, beneficial to the environment, beneficial beyond you.
Yeah.
Isn't being a good provider, I mean, isn't that in there somewhere, is good work, good provider in some cases?
Yeah. So that the paycheck business is not just nice. Most of us work for some kind of livelihood. Now Charles Schulz, you know, by the time he's getting $30 million a year because you bought your grandchild sheets with Snoopy on them, he's not working for the paycheck anymore. And people who are retired, who do volunteer work, they're not working for the paycheck anymore either. People who come up here and work, those Mavericks are not playing, they're working. So there are times when work isn't equivalent with employment, but in our society, most often, we're taught when we use the word work, except isn't it interesting talking about professional sports? You play professional sports for money, yeah.
No, I'm not sure that the Mavericks aren't playing.
Well, they, yes. I think they do. There is this component of it, but they are laboring.
Yeah. But I think, for instance, a child's work is to play.
Right. Right. And that's the Montessori, behind the philosophy of Montessori education, is everything they do is work. Right? Because work is an expression of your being. Right? So they don't say you play beads, you work with the numbers. Okay, now that's to kind of get our brain going to think about, well, what is work? There are lots of places that we get our understanding of that. Our own experience, what we actually have for work, what our aspirations are. Sometimes we think there's got to be another way, right? Than the one I have. We see someone else's. And this is maybe the moment to say something about books that are in the bookstore. Barker Palmer is a Quaker educator. He's written this lovely, and there maybe is only this one left that I brought to show, called Let Your Life Speak, Listening for the Voice of Vocation. He talks about when he was in high school, the jobs, the kind of work he aspired to, and that it was based largely on his observation of other people. And one of his friend's dad was in advertising, and he thought he wanted that. Lee Hardy, who's a philosopher, teaches at Calvin College, has written this book called The Fabric of This World, Inquiries into Calling, Career Choice, and the Design of Human Work. It isn't a very catchy title, but it's a great book. And Hardy gives these examples of his the jobs he had in college in the summer. And he knew he didn't want that based on his experience, right? He worked in the farmer's market in LA. And because he was non-union, the non-union workers had to pick up all the fruit that wasn't in a crate because the union contract said they didn't have to pick up anything that wasn't in a crate. And he just knew he didn't want that. So our own experience is one. What we observe in others, aspirations, what we see in the movies, right? And what we see in novels. We get an idea about what kind of work we could do and what the consequences would be. That has some point of overlap with vocation that we talked about before. And I want to review that a little bit. I put up a whole bunch of words that sometimes get used as near synonyms. They're not synonyms. Although when we're being less than careful with our language, it's often the way we use language, less than carefully, we use them kind of as synonyms. A job, a career, a profession, a trade, a vocation, a calling. let's start down here, and I just want to say some things about the technical theological use of the word vocation. It's a noun, right? Mm-hmm. A vocation is a noun, but it has in its root the word voice. So vocation is a voice, it's somewhere you get because of a voice. Somewhere you get because of a voice.
A voice outside of you?
You are the fine student who makes the next point. Now, what voice? Is it a voice from the outside? That's the mainstream Protestant understanding of vocation that comes from the 16th century reformers, Luther and Calvin in particular, is that the voice that calls, here's the verb, that is calling us, is God's voice. And it comes externally. It is not a matter of self-expression. Now, someone like Parker Palmer, who comes out of the radical Reformation tradition from the Quakers, well, it's not where he began, but it's where he is now. He argues against that. He says, no, vocation is internal. Right? It's from the inside. I'm not sure that those are two different things. At least I think it's possible to consider that that both are a way of responding, our way of apprehending God's intention. Okay, both can be a way of apprehending God's intention. I'm trying to think of an image that allows that. It might be a kind of magnetic force. Because a magnet, you know, if you can let God be the magnet and you be the metal, you got to have both parts. Right? So the magnet calls out from the inside, or here's the other way to put it, that vocation is both the voice and the response. So even if we go back to this, we do us, I'm going to say, well, what are the common popular ways we use the word call? To call someone on the phone, and you, if you allow, God is calling you on the phone. It doesn't do any good if God calls you on the phone if you don't at least pick up your messages. Would be nice if you'd be there to say, hello, what have you got in mind for me? But it, you got to at least pick up the messages so that there's both voice and hearing. And then something happens, and here I put up words that Roman Catholics are more likely to use, but I think are really helpful for us as we're trying to understand how these go with these. That is to say, a vocation and calling go with job, career, that little cluster. One is charism, right? Do you know that word, of course, from charismatic, in both the religious and the political sense? In both cases, the root there is gift, right? This is, after Vatican II, what all the religious orders were instructed to do, to revisit their original charism. What was the original gift of the Jesuits? What was the original gift of the Sisters of Mercy? To, in corporate ease, we'd say, what's your mission statement? Right? Right? I think, why don't we just say, what's your mission? What's your mission? That then results in an apostolate. The gift leads to the sending. This morning, as Franz started us out in Paul's letter to the Galatians, you hear this stuff, Paul, an apostle, one sent by God. And that's what we're interested in, I think, when we talk about work, is God sending us into our work? Can God send us into this work or that work? How do we choose what's going on? But what's important, one of the things that's really important about looking at job, career, profession, trade, work, all of those things related to vocation, is that here we're interested in both, if you will, the motive or the origin and the outcome of work. God sends, but the neighbor receives. That's always in vocation, whether we're talking about the world of work or the world of family or the world of citizenship. Gustav Wingren, a Swedish theologian, has written a really fine study on, called Luther on Vocation, which was out of print for years and years and years, has now come out in a reprint from some funny little company in Indiana. And Wingren helps us to see the relationship between the origin and the outcome, which is perhaps most important when we talk about work, but it's important in other ways as well. Now, the first thing I want to say about this is that I've made two nice color-coded columns here. So the danger is, when you see these two nice color-coded columns, that you think they're separate from each other. They're not separate from each other. They're parts of a whole. Okay, they're parts of a whole, and they need each other. Right, so they're not, I don't mean to talk here about a dualism. I'm talking about a two-part whole. Can't stress that enough. Here's the person, here's the believer, here's the baptized one, this little, lovely little red stick figure with a head, a heart, and hands, okay? Now, the way Luther teaches us to understand this is that God gives us faith, right? I cannot by my own reason or understanding, we all learn this in Luther's Small Catechism, God gives us faith. And as we talked about last time, that means that we receive a kind of passive righteousness. It's Luther's category. It's righteousness that comes to us without our action. So think of it in the passive voice. Again, as Franz was saying this morning, we receive this. And it affects how we stand before God. So that by faith, we come before God cleansed, or clothed in the cloak of Christ, or however you want to image that change, the gift of faith makes us acceptable in God's sight. Sometimes Luther talks about that in terms of heaven or the things that are above us. God's grace changes the things that are above us, and we're not free with regard to that. Right? We're free to reject it, but we're not free to make it happen. And that's eternal. That's, remember I said last time, that vocation is something between Christ's resurrection and our own. But faith extends beyond that resurrection into eternity. Now, some of you will recognize this is kind of the two kingdoms business. I'm a little nervous always about the spatial image of that. It makes it real easy to divide it up. I'm more with time, because there's eternal time, but eternal time is now and continues. And then on the green side, there's temporal time now that will end. But they're simultaneous, both kinds of time. You see what I'm saying? Okay, so now this is the origin of the call. Especially this is the origin of what I said last time. There are three kinds of call. The call to salvation, or the call of grace. And then there's the big C call, which is to witness. And then three, the multiple callings, which then I should have switched to green, because really these, which are directed not to how we stand before God, but how we stand before or toward or among our neighbor. These are temporal or temporary. They're now. They're not less important because they're not going to last forever, right? Think about cooking. You could say, well, don't pay any attention to the food because it's only on the table for an hour at the most. It's temporary. No, it's really important. It's really important. Just because it's going to end doesn't mean it doesn't matter. But it is different. Here is where we become, where our passive righteousness that is a gift is activated. And we do something. We're free to do that. And again, this is below or on earth. So, the question, is it just a job? Comes back to these issues. And some might think that if the answer is yes, that's a great relief. It's just a job. It's only temporal. It's very freeing. I just spent 2 years closing an academic program, and one of the phrases that I would use occasionally that made people laugh, I'd say, I'm getting ready to make a decision about something, I'd say, so, what are they going to do? Close the program. Oh, it's very free, you know? So what? Nothing to lose. It's only temporal. I remember one of my friends getting a temporary job. She wasn't too thrilled about it. She said, the great thing about this job, it's temporary. Okay. On the other hand, is it just a job? No, it's really important. It gives meaning. Some balance between the two, probably, that we're looking at. Okay. Which then leads me to want to talk about work and anthropology. Let me just erase. When we're talking about callings, I was going to read this one. I have all these quotations up here. Some of them I'll point to and say something about, and some I won't. But this Luther quote. But God has commanded us to put our whole trust in his mercy with utter certainty and without any doubt to have faith that we ourselves and all our works are pleasing to God, not because of our worthiness or merit, but because of his goodness. And that's what we say, this blue stuff, the things above, the things that are eternal, take off some of the pressure about doing good works, right? And at the same time, give us courage to work. All right, now, another way of coming to the question of what constitutes good work is not to ask ourselves what is righteous, because we've left that behind, right? We've disposed of that question, does what I do change who I am before God? Luther has said, and I hope we can at least for the sake of the argument say, yes, I think I understand that, I think I experienced that. What I do does not change how I am before God. But I have to do something. And what makes that work good? One way to come at that is to remember who we are. So we're talking about human work, and we're looking for some fit between the two, being human and doing work. Or it's my work, some fit between me and my work that allows me to faithfully respond to the big C call. And when we talk about work, job, profession, etc., we're talking about one of these multiple callings. So we would say if the whole of your life, you make your whole of your life as a circle, that lovely Billy Collins poem, now is it a halo, is it a zero, what is it? But it's a circle, probably work is about this much. And then we've got rest, and we've got eating, and we've got being a friend, and recreation, and you know, you could fill up all the little pie slices there. The point of that pie chart is to say that I'm now taking as a given that job or work, it's part of one's vocation, but it's not the whole of one's vocation. Because one of the questions we all ask about work and vocation is, how does it, is that too big of a chunk? Okay, human work or my work? That then leads us to the question of the relationship between work and anthropology. What does it mean to be a human being? And who am I as a human being? And what do these gifts tell us? Lee Hardy, in this book I already mentioned, the first chapter is a really informative, helpful overview of views of work, starting with the Greek philosophers through medieval Christianity, up through some of the 19th and 20th century thinkers like Freud and Marx. To help us think about this question, I'll just read you very, when he sets this up. Hence there's disagreement as to what is godlike about us human beings and what kind of lives we should lead. Western attitudes toward work have been directly and decisively shaped by our self-understandings as they follow from our understanding of God. Work has sometimes been seen as an activity which demotes us to the level of animal existence. Sometimes as an activity which exalts us to the status of divine beings. Attitude towards work have either been, accordingly, either negative or positive, right? Because if work is the thing we do that makes us like animals, and we don't care for animals, we want to say human beings are more than animals, then work will be seen as a burden, a curse, shameful. Yeah, Carol.
Well, I don't want to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Well, it just occurred to me because I've just for the first time seen all these words on the board together, and it occurred to me that our attitude towards these words, it has something to do with linguistics, that that the word, I mean, I'm guessing, because I really don't know this, but my guess is that the word job is Anglo-Saxon in origin, whereas all the others, maybe with the exception of trade, are of Latin origin.
Well,
and maybe charism and apostolate have Greek origin. But so I'm wondering if we aren't into a class division there.
Yeah.
Just by virtue, I mean, it may not have anything to do with it, but well, there's something about that reduction of the of our lives to kind of an animal existence, because mm-hmm. the Anglo-Saxons were, I mean, that was not high class. That's
right.
English origins are, all the words that have to do with higher class stuff are French or
yeah.
or Norman.
Now, calling, Einar Billing argues, or is it Vingren? One of them argued that calling you and its cognates you really only find in the Germanic languages,
uh-huh.
and that it's not in the Romance languages.
Yeah,
there may be something to the linguistics of that.
I don't know what it has to do with anything. But
yeah, but it is interesting. Yeah. What Hardy is getting at here, and what he sees, for example, in the Greeks, is that they understand work to be an extension of the body. And so work is what you do to survive, to feed yourself, right? So that you'll live, so you won't die. But then finally you die anyway. And so since they understood also the human person to be more than a body, and preferred rather than the temporal, the eternal, right? Then the goal is to have enough resources that you can have someone else do that, what we sometimes call productive labor or even reproductive labor, the stuff you have to do over and over and over and over. I was standing in the dish pit yesterday doing pots, you know, and next to me is Saul, who's a floater this summer, which means, right, he goes every time, not every time, all day he fixes things that have broken. And tomorrow there are as many. It's an endless task.
There's another word, task.
Yeah. It will never end. There will always be something else that's broken. There will always be another dish to wash, another meal to make. It goes on and on and on. So the Greek philosophical tradition was that the way you get past that and are elevated above the animal beastly level is to be a free male of some means, so you could have women and slaves to free you from this earthly endless task, and then you could be contemplative. Not that you would engage always in pleasure. That was like cows grazing. No, that wasn't the goal. The goal was to develop the spiritual side, to develop the soul. Now, the way Hardy tells this story, this continues into medieval Christianity. It's a more complicated picture than he's setting out there. And in part because he's working from older scholarship, and people like Carolyn Walker Bynum have helped us understand the dualisms of the medieval Christianity a little more complicated way. But if you're going to make an oversimplification, yeah, in medieval Christianity, through Augustine and Aquinas, we have that same notion that the best life is the one that frees you from the unending, really non-productive activity of this world. So to be a choir sister, and you could spend your day singing and praying. Now, what happens in the 16th century with Luther is that vocation gets a different meaning. Calling shifts, in part because, or I don't want to say because, I want to make this causal, at the same time that we get a different understanding of the relationship between the parts of the person. That all of those things that were on the green side, all the earthly life, all the temporal things are no longer of no importance. They're not of eternal importance, but they are of immediate importance. So that in one's vocation, one turns one's gifts, the ones that you've received from God, to do benefit to the neighbor. Doesn't help God one way or the other. But it helps the neighbor beyond measure if you show up and say, "Boy, I noticed that you're having a hard time getting the groceries in. Let me help you." Or, real example, unless you're the one who can't get the groceries in. But to look at the neighbor's needs and to use those. One of the things that does in the 16th century, which was in Germany, was not as concerned with social mobility as we are, right? Is it gave every station meaning. Whatever job you have is a way to do God's work for the neighbor, right? If God gives, remember when you pray the Lord's Prayer and then you go and you read Luther's Catechism and his explanation to the petition for daily bread. It's all this, God cares about all that stuff. And we pray for it, not because God wouldn't give us to us anyway, because of course God does, but that we would participate in that in a certain way. We come to value those things for their immediate temporal use. But it also means that our work has meaning. And the milkmaid's meaning has no less meaning than the magistrate's meaning, right? The painter's meaning has no less meaning than the priest's meaning. There's a kind of telos, a goal, an outcome that is important. But the outcome is only important now. Doesn't affect what happens before God, but it matters now. We're able to do it because of what's already been taken care of eternally. Today, we have choices to make and we have mobility. And so our concern, the way vocation helps us, is a little bit different. It does give meaning to every task, but it also compels us when we think about those choices about how to make them. Lee Hardy, when he then comes in his second chapter to talk about vocation, very helpfully says this, that there are three elements in good work. One, livelihood. You gotta be able to eat. Now in Maslow's, hierarchy of needs, this is low, but it's basic. If you don't have that, you can't get to the other ones. So livelihood. Two, and you guys got all of these, is satisfaction. Notice this does not necessarily equal success or happiness or self-expression. Although those could be part of it. But he says satisfaction, a sense of accomplishment. That there's a kind of rightness about it. It fits. It's fitting. Maybe would be another way to put it. And then the third is making a difference. Not just the same thing over and over, which actually feeding people is the same thing over and over, but it's making it. If you didn't feed them, there would be a consequence and it would not be a happy one. So Hardy says these three address who we are as human beings. We need livelihood. In our money-based society, that's cash. If you're in a society with sustenance farming, it's You know, it's why those people left Norway, because there wasn't a livelihood. You just couldn't get enough fish. Or someone came up to me last night and said, in their family, the story is the problem was their farm was on the shady side of the fjord. And on the shady side, you just get one hay crop. On the sunny side, you got three. So the people on the shady side immigrated. Because you gotta have enough to make it. And then it should be satisfying. There should be some match between the charism and the need. You make me be a choir director, we would be miserable, right? Proofreader, very bad idea. No match between my total lack of spelling ability and the responsibility of that job. There are other, or preschool teacher, would not work. There are other things I'm good at. Those are not them. Okay, so some kind of match between what your gifts are and what needs to be done. I'm looking for that one. Well, here, I'll give you this wonderful piece from one of my favorite fictional wrestlings with vocation is Dorothy Sayers' novel, Gaudy Night. Yes.
Right.
And I wrote this down, where do I have the quote? Harriet Vane, some of you know it and some of you don't, but here's what she, how, in a way where she puts, how the way she puts it. I know what you're thinking, that anyone with proper sensitive feeling would rather scrub floors for a living than write detective stories. Harriet had been tried for murder, and so, you know. But I scrub floors very badly, and I write detective stories rather well. I didn't see why proper feeling should prevent me from doing my proper job. Frederick Buechner puts it this way, that vocation is where our great gladness meets the world's great need. Okay? But that's satisfaction. It's not necessarily cheerfulness or adulation. Right? And then making a difference. Doing something that... Well, and here it was, we come to other of Dorothy Sayers' work. And Dorothy Sayers' understanding of anthropology in her book Mind of the Maker, she makes a very plausible argument that to be created in God's image, a key characteristic is that we are creative beings. And so good work is work that allows us as human beings to engage in creative action. Okay? And it's a complicated argument she makes, but I see we're near the end. It allows us, and one of the things that I regard as very important about what Sayers says here is that it allows us to counteract one of the dangers of the 16th century understanding of vocation. Because the danger of the 16th century understanding of vocation, which emphasizes so much, especially in Luther, less in Calvin, the needs of the neighbor and the telos or the goal of the station or the office, is it can become very static, stagnant, and burdensome. You're just stuck there. And Sayers gives us a way to both say, it's not good work for me. It's not a creative action for me. And to say, that's not work anybody should have to do. If you can make any work into a vocation, the danger is you go to those poor child laborers in Indonesia making winter boots and say, oh, well, the way, you know, you got to think about the needs of your neighbors in Duluth, because they really need these snowmobile boots and you're really helping them out. Mm-hmm. You know, while that's consistent with the doctrine of vocation, doesn't it kind of make you go, oh, yuck, something's wrong here? And Sayers by her emphasis on the necessity of work being creative, gives us a way to offer a critique there. Oh my goodness, I've gone on and on. Well, we haven't talked about discernment and how one decides which job. Or Dan's really, you know, pointed and poignant question last time about can you make a wrong choice? He asked the question, can you make a wrong career choice? And I said, well, that's different than can you make a wrong vocational choice? Sayers, I think, allows us to say, yeah, sometimes you pick something that isn't satisfying and making a difference, or that doesn't give livelihood. Now, I want to say one more thing about this triad of Hardys. They come in different proportions, in different people, and in different times of our lives. So that job that Lee Hardy had, picking up uncrated fruit, didn't give him a lot of personal satisfaction, and the difference it made was pretty remote from his activity. But at that point, what was key was livelihood. Sayers would urge us, I think, to consider that proportion can be sustained only in a temporary situation, in which work only is livelihood. You may be able to do it for a summer job. Or, you know, when I was 14, we all detasseled corn. But it was only for 2 weeks. And when I went home at night, I got clean clothes and dinner. It wasn't a life of migrant labor. Right? So the questions this leaves us with, is there a wrong choice? Can a job be just a job, or does it have to give your life meaning? And how does work interact with the rest of life, which is one's whole vocation? There are a lot of questions there that I hope you will take with you and talk about at coffee and over lunch and the trails and at home.
On the boat.
On the boat. Because we are to the end. I'm sorry I went on so long.
I would like to say something to the Stanford student. Somebody asked him, what's your name?
Jeff.
Somebody asked Jeff, what do you want to do for a living? Jeff, keep in mind that your freshman year of college is a sort of an exploration and growing year.
Yeah.
And your sophomore year is the most fun of all. That's where you can be anything. And you really don't start feeling what you really want to do with your life until you're a junior or senior, am I right?
Often.
I've noticed that.
I knew from the time I was about six.
Well,
yeah.
Some
varies.
People, but most college students feel very, in fact, you go in and you think, I'm going to do this. And by the time you're a senior, you change your major. They change their majors all the time.
And then this, I guess this is the one that's good prompting to the one thing I do want to say finally at the end, is that the notion of vocation is not something you get. We talk about getting a job, finding a career, discovering what you're training for a profession. All of these are things that can be future tense. But a vocation is not future tense. Vocation is always present tense. Right? You have a vocation now. And it can be to be a student. It can be to be, you know, wherever you are, whatever your relationships and responsibilities are, those are the callings in which we make responsible use of the gifts God has given us. Okay, Carol.
I've had quite a number of conversations with my music director at church, and she's very creative, and unfortunately this society, except for the very, very most cream of the crop of artistic types, don't doesn't pay well enough to support them in that calling or a trade or whatever you want to call that. And so therefore, she's been struggling all along to find a job that will not use all her creative energies,
right,
but will pay enough to keep the bills and the bill collectors
right
at bay, so that she can be freed up to do the kind of creative
yeah
stuff in her free time.
Yeah.
And I think, I really think that there are lots of people in that category, not necessarily always the artist, but
right,
but that, you know, that they have to find a job that will support them in order to be able to pursue what really is
the
self-expression.
A similar but different situation is people whose work, in part because of opportunity,
yeah,
the work they have may not allow for a great deal of personal satisfaction or making a difference. And often for those people, what we call avocations
yeah
become the place where that meaning and making a difference really happens. And frankly, I just say there are days when I think 9 to 5, close the door, go home. I kind of like one of those. You know, that would be okay. And then I could have time for thinking and doing good works and, you know. So there's a balancing of the whole, these three things, not just in work, but in the rest, right?
Yeah.
And there's a balancing over time as well. So here we're getting off into relationships. But all of us know, you can be friends with someone who's real needy for a certain amount of time. And then you begin to think, if this is going on forever, you can still be my neighbor, as it were, and I can still meet your needs. But the notion that this is a friendship has yeah somehow shifted, because I'm not getting any livelihood from it,
yeah,
right? I have to go get my little boy.
Is that okay?
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a test.
At this moment.
But you're making a difference in this one.
Yeah, well, we hope so.
I love the part.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.